to Mythic Imagination. Hi, I'm Honora Foa. Tonight's podcast is about the hero's journey. Our special guests are O.R. Melling, Saban Fusome, and Peter Beagle. Each is an award-winning author with different thoughts on what constitutes a heroic quest. Their diverse cultures and countries of origin add interesting textures and flavors to their ideas about heroism. We'll speak first with O.R. Melling from her home in Ireland.
You were saying the topic is to do with the hero's quest, which of course is an absolute essential of my stories. They are hero's journeys, every one of them. And I suppose in some ways what makes me different, at least from the writers I read when I was young, is that the hero is always a young woman adventuring away. And this satisfies something that I wanted when I was young and reading my favorite stories, but where it always seemed to be that the hero was a young man. And I think one of the reasons these stories are so, why they mean so much, why they resonate so strongly for us, is that, of course, life itself is a hero's journey, and we are each the hero of our life's journey. And in this way, you know, we face obstacles, we suffer tragedy, we are always overcoming them as long as we are here, as long as we're still on the road, alive and breathing. We are still on the journey. We are still on the quest. And it doesn't end until we die. And I think in that way, that's why heroes' journeys resonate for us. We know that they are the soul's version of what we are undergoing in our daily life.
Orla, do you see the hero as having to make it on his or her own, or do you think that the hero has significant help along the way? Can it be that the story itself is a guide to our heroic journeys?
Yeah, and I suppose I see them as guides. Certainly they've hero stories have been guides for me. I think that one of the favorite things I love quoting is Gottfried von Strasberg's statement about why he wrote the story of Tristan. He said he did it out of a labor of love to comfort noble hearts. And I think that the hero stories, the quest stories, do that. They comfort us as we undergo the obstacles and hardship of our life's journey. And I think they encourage us to that form of nobility when faced with hardship. You know, the choice of going under or the choice of struggling on. Certainly that's at hard times in my life, whether it was as a child reading the Narnian Chronicles or even now, I find things are bleak. I find The Lord of the Rings is definitely a great pick-me-up.
We'll be hearing more from O.R. Melling at Mythic Journeys this June, where she will be one of our presenters. Now let's hear what Saban Fusome has to say about the heroic tradition in her home country of Africa.
The idea of the hero quest in Africa is one that is community-based. I know that in some areas, you know, it can be individual-based, but for the most part, I know for sure in my culture that no heroic action really comes with any one person. If you are able to do it, it's because you have a community behind you. So therefore, it is thanks to the community you have been able to make such a thing happen. And so the mindset is more community-oriented, so that, for instance, when you have been able to rescue someone who was drowning, for instance, your ability to rescue that person, even if no other human being was around, is dependent on some divinities, on some ancestors who were a part of the invisible community that were present at that moment and that helped you to be able to achieve this. And so, and I take it because in that way is because the culture is very community-oriented, where your biggest wealth is not money you have in your bank account, but the numbers of people you have in your life, so that if you do not have enough people in your life, you would be considered poor because you don't have the wealth. A way of sharing your trouble, your pain, your joy, and so forth with other people, that you'll be narrowed down to not being able to have joy in your life, actually. And so the different myth about heroes always ends with a community flavor in it and so forth.
The idea that the hero is created and supported by the community is one that seems entirely foreign to Western ideas of the Lone Ranger, who at best has an inconsequential sidekick. But even so, in the old stories from European traditions, though the individuality is emphasized, there is a strong sense of being surrounded by invisible presences or watchers, whether animal or fairy godmother, and that the journey itself, though hazardous and full of trials, has an inevitability. Saban Fusome's tradition carries within it the reality of an ecology encompassing humans and nature, the living and the dead. One of the truest ways to begin a deeper experience of a story is to treat it like a dream. That is, that all of the characters, events, and feelings are of one piece. With a dream, you are all of the characters, and with a story, it is also artificial to feel or think that the hero is somehow sliced out, that the story is only the hero's story. The hero is the whole ecology of the story. All that is around her is all that is within her. Our next guest is Peter Beagle. We are speaking with him from his home on the West Coast. Peter, you've written many books involving heroes. Do these heroes pop out of your head, fully developed, like Athena popping out of the head of Zeus? Or does it take you a while to dig into mythic traditions and ferret your characters from the collective repository?
Yeah, Tamsin is actually based on historical... It's set in the 20th century, but the original of the quest goes back to the late 1600s, which isn't particularly a period I know a great deal about. I'm much better than the Elizabethans. But my father was a history teacher, and he had told me about what's called Monmouth's Rebellion, which was a specific Dorset rebellion, badly planned and badly executed, attempting to overthrow James II for excellent reasons. He was not a nice man, put his half-brother on the throne. And the whole thing fell completely apart, and a great many innocent people were killed. And James II, securely on his throne, sent Judge Jeffreys, who gives new meaning to the term hanging judge, sent Judge Jeffreys down to Dorset to explain very firmly to people, innocent or not, why you do not ever raise your hand against a king. And Jeffreys is still a legend, you know, for cruelty and insane viciousness in Dorset 300 years later, more than 300 years later. The villain of the book is the ghost of Judge Jeffreys, as it happens, but the quest, if you will, belongs to the ghost, Tamsin, who died at that time in 1685, the age of 20, and who should not be in this house where a transplanted New York teenager discovers her. She should have gone on to wherever it is that ghosts go, and nobody in the story has any idea, including Tamsin herself. She just knows she shouldn't be still in that house where she died. And the girl, Jenny, who narrates the story, undertakes a quest, if you like, to find out why Tamsin is there, and to help her move on, and also to rescue her from the ghost of Judge Jeffreys, who was obsessed with her in 1685 and is obsessed with her now, and wants literally to draw her ghost into himself, to make them one, if you like, so that whatever else happens, she'll never be free of him. And I brought in a fair number of local legends, specifically, pretty specific to Dorset, because every shire of England has its own legends and its own mythic figures. And I went back as far as a woman called the Old Lady of the Elder Tree, which is very much Dorset. And I think she's, as far as I ever could make out, an earth goddess, much older than the Christian tradition in England. In the end, Jenny has seen her around in her modern guise, which is, you know, a crabby old farm lady and, you know, rubber boots and a moth-eaten cardigan sweater with a peculiarly nasty little dog. And Jenny is forever rescuing the dog, either from her own cat or from messes he gets himself into. And in the end, that may be what has the Old Lady of the Elder Tree on her side when she's finally revealed for what she is, and that dog, that nasty little dog, is revealed for what it really is. And it was the deepest I've gone into mythology, local or other, in a very long time. I usually have more fun making up my own. But I'm proud of that book and very fond of it. I don't know if it falls exactly into the hero's quest category, but Jenny definitely is a hero. And she does go on a quest without moving very far geographically. But the 700 acres of that farm are her battleground.
Peter, it's often said that a story is only as good as its villain. What's your take on the need for bad guys in a story, and what might that mean for our personal journeys into the netherworld?
It's funny because I'm like Thurber's Golux, who says that he had great visions of being evil when I was two, but it kind of ended when I rescued a... when I got involved with a firefly that had gotten caught in the spider's web. And the prince he's telling the story to says, of course, you rescued the firefly. So I rescued the spider, the blinking arsonist that set the web on fire. And I also have, I'm sure, from time to time, great hopes of being a proper scoundrel. But, you know, they always fall through. I can never possibly pull them off. I don't know that just the spur of the moment I can think of anything like that. The nearest I've gotten to it, I suppose, is that I had no compunction about stealing from Safeway when we were poor to feed my kids, or stealing from bookshops to feed me. And yet my morality is strange. You never steal from libraries. That's wrong. That's not just bad karma. I mean, even if there isn't such a thing as hell, it would create it for somebody who steals books from libraries. Bad. And that's about, you know, as far as I've gone into the netherworld. I do know that I had a friend who's dead now, bone cancer. He was a musician, and I was sort of in charge of making sure that he got to the doctor, got his medications when he was supposed to. But we were standing in a corner in San Francisco one day, and he mentioned, "Yeah, I understand you're a writer. You're interested in people's stories. And that might be interested, but I never told you this, but I was a bank robber." And I gulped and managed to say, "Well, that's a living. That too is a living." And he laughed a little sadly and said, "It is if you're good at it." I wasn't. Did 7 years in San Quentin. Bad career choice. And he got out and went back to being a musician. One of the nicest people I ever knew.
So what are the nuances about the making of a good villain? Are there subtleties?
I wrote something about that, as a matter of fact, writing about Tolkien's Gollum and talking about the different kinds of villains, you know, including the great ones. The Thurber's The Duke of Coffin Castle is wonderful, where he says, "We all have our flaws, and mine is being wicked." And you can't do better than that, but Judge Jeffreys is the only one of my villains I've ever actually hated. I've always had a soft spot for my villains and felt sorry for them. And there's even a moment when 13-year-old Jenny realizes that he's crazy and also realizes that this is a man who really does believe that by being in love with Tamsin, he's lining himself up for hell, that he's perfectly ready, you know, to go to hell because of what he's done, if he can have her. And Jenny just thinks, I don't know, maybe it's only the maniacs who really know how to love. I don't know.
Well, maybe that's the best thought that we can leave you with. Maybe it's only the maniacs who really know how to love. So to all the heroic love-possessed, blessings. Mythic Imagination is a production of the Mythic Imagination Institute. The sound designer for Mythic Imagination is Brad Barnett. Special thanks to Creative Digital Group for the generous use of their studio. Find them on the web at creativedigitalgroup.com. The producer of Mythic Imagination is Donna Barnett. Our musical introduction is by Jeffrey Armus. He can be found on the web at jeffreyarmus.com, GeoffreyArmes. It was an honor speaking with our guests. O.R. Melling is the author of The Chronicles of Faery, which includes the award-winning title Hunter's Moon. Her new book, Summer King, is being released this spring. Orla will join us at Mythic Journeys in June. She can be found on the web at www.ormelling.com. Sabanfu Somme, who was raised in the West African Dagara tribe, will also be at Mythic Journeys. She is the author of The Spirit of Intimacy, Ancient African Teachings in the Ways of Relationships, Welcoming Spirit Home, and Falling Out of Grace, What We Learn About Life's Challenges. Find her on the web at www.sobonfu.com. That's SOBONFU.com. Peter Beagle is the author of the fantasy classic The Last Unicorn. His latest work, Summer Long, will be released this year. Peter was at our last Mythic Journeys conference and will be returning in June. Visit Peter on the web at www.conlanpress.com, C-O-N-L-A-N Press. All three of our guests will be presenters at Mythic Journeys, our conference and performance festival set for June 7th through the 11th. They will be joined by over 100 other presenters and performers. To find out more about Mythic Journeys, visit our website, mythicimagination.org. Thank you very much for listening. We'd love to hear your insights and suggestions. Please email them to info@mythicjourneys.org. Tonight, we'll leave you with a song by Heather Dale called The Road to Santiago. The song's theme is the emotional swell that captivates all who quest, the never-ending tide that pulls at our hearts until we take the plunge. The song is the title song from her CD, The Road to Santiago. Please find Heather on the web at www.heatherdale.com. Heather Dale will be performing at Mythic Journeys this June.
A townsman's life is even like the dust upon the road, not changing with the seasons, just fortune's fickle load. But sitting on my step and bending hide and thread to task, I saw the first man walking. I saw the first man walking. I saw the first of many walking past. In ones and twos they traveled, the first hints of the wave. With hat and stick and scallop, they would go to see the grave of a saint who'd lived among us, a town he'd come to save as he walked along the road to Santiago. With pennies in their pockets and blisters on their feet, they'd come within their weariness, the humble and the meek. For while a day could bring them wages, these months would bring release from the road that they were walking, this road that they were walking, this road that led them forth in their belief. Soon the trickle was a torrent, then the torrent was a flood, and like Noah, how they laughed amid the gadflies and the mud. And I wondered what they shared that made such disparate men beloved as they walked along the road to Santiago. From Germany, and one from here in Spain, and one from near the Bosphorus, where Constantine had reigned. From every land they sallied forth, and ventured home again, and found the road worth walking. They found this road worth walking, for all agreed their roads were much the same. And so I laid my work aside, long toils would keep. For what was said, a man must sow if he intends to reap. And so with a laugh I set to putting blisters on my feet, as I joined them on the road to Santiago.
Remember, at Mythic Imagination, every life is a story, and a story can change the world.